Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good morning to you all, and welcome to the 10th lecture of the 2018 Palliative Care Lecture Series. Hospice New Zealand would like to thank and acknowledge Cancer Research Trust New Zealand for their generous support and funding to deliver these free lectures. The lecture today will be recorded, and it will be available on the Hospice New Zealand website. Please be aware, there will be an opportunity for questions at the end of the presentation. We would now like to introduce our guest speaker today, Bridget Carla, clinical nurse educator at Nearing Hospital in Australia. Welcome, Bridget. Please go ahead.
Oh, hello. Good morning, everybody. I hope you can all hear me very well. I would just like to, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to present. I have never done a presentation on a telephone conference like this before where I don't get feedback from the audience and I can't hear if you're laughing at my jokes, but I hope that you are. I also didn't realize that it was going to be 5:30 in the morning when I started presenting, so I do hope I'm awake enough and I give a good presentation. Just a brief introduction again. I'm a clinical nurse educator at Naringa Hospital. We are a 19-bedded palliative care unit in Sydney, Australia, northwestern Sydney, Australia. That's my brief introduction. So I'll get started now. So what I'm talking about is putting sexuality and intimacy on the agenda in the palliative care ward. I'm moving on to the next slide now, so that'll be slide number two. So we're a 19-bedded palliative care unit, as I said. We conducted a survey from staff to ask them how they were able to put sexuality onto the agenda in the ward. I will present to you the results of the survey, and I will present the education that was given to the staff. And I will also present the strategies that we implemented and discuss that with you. So I just want to have a little brief sidetrack here and say that this is not a PhD thesis. We found a gap in the holistic treatment of our patients and did a little research study, and we implemented a program that we find really works with our patients regarding the sexuality and intimacy needs of our palliative care patients. We conducted our study in 2016, and we are still seeing the benefits, the practical benefits of improving our holistic care of our patients. So I'm just going to the next slide now, entitled Background. Research has shown that patients in palliative care have unmet sexual needs. It has also shown that the patients would like the staff to initiate the conversation. Going on to the next slide, continuing with background, sexuality is a part of the holistic care of our patients. It's linked to the wholeness of a person, which is threatened by life-limiting illness. And I will go into more detail of how it can be threatened in palliative care situations. It's important for us to normalize sexuality and intimacy. We had some incidences on our unit where staff found it uncomfortable when patients were expressing some kind of need. One of them walked in while the patients were having a cuddle with their partner, and the staff member actually reacted in a way that was embarrassing to the couple. She made a joke about it and even mentioned it the next day to the patient and her partner. Another case occurred when a couple had been recently married in our palliative care unit, and they were actually caught having sex together. And while some of us thought that was absolutely wonderful, some of the nurses verbalized that they thought the couple was acting inappropriately. So we had to normalize sexuality and normalize these issues, and this is why we brought this to the attention. This is why we did this project. Staff may feel uncomfortable about the whole issue and the needed education. That's what we felt. This emphasized the need to determine who should be responsible for initiating the conversation for these patients and the importance of providing training to the health personnel involved in this care. I'm just moving on to the no, this is not the next slide, sorry. All right, so what we asked our the survey, just some basic questions we asked our staff members was, what does the term sexuality and intimacy mean to you, was the first question. The second question was, how do you relate the term sexuality and intimacy to patients in palliative care service? Third question was, do you think that patients with a life-limiting illness have unmet sexual and intimacy needs? Question number four is, are you comfortable discussing sexuality and intimacy with a patient? Number five was, have you ever considered the patient's sexual orientation when admitting a patient? If a patient was belonging to the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual, intersexual group, LGBTI, would you feel comfortable discussing their sexuality and intimacy needs, was question number six. Question number seven was, who do you think should raise the issue of sexual and intimacy needs for our patients? Question number eight was, what obstacles do you see palliative care patients may have that prevent them from expressing their sexuality? Then a bit of some open-ended questions was, some of the reasons I, as a health professional, struggle to open the conversation with my patients regarding sexual and intimacy are, and then they were able to give us a description of what they found they struggled with. And then we were interested to find out whether or not anyone had ever experienced a scenario when the patient themselves raised an issue about sexuality and intimacy, and we asked the staff to describe it. The answer really was, it wasn't really, some of the nurses, it wasn't really a nurse that in the inpatient unit, because this study was done in an inpatient unit, but we did ask some of our community outreach staff members to answer the questions as well, and our staff had actually not said, in the inpatient unit, very few nurses had actually had this experience. And also the last question we asked was, can you think of ways that we can improve sexuality, intimacy conversations, issues, and concerns in palliative care patients at Naringa? So I'm moving on to the next slide now, I think I might have got my numbers wrong now. I think it's number eight. It's called Sexuality and Intimacy, What Does This Mean? And if there are any red on your slides, that means that those are the answers that the staff have actually made to our questions. So when you see a red note, just know that those are the staff members' answers. So just to carry on with what is sexuality and intimacy, what the research shows, what the definitions are. Sexuality is an intrinsic part of being human, and it can be an intimate form of communication that can relieve suffering. There is an assumption that sexuality means sexual intercourse and function, but patients in palliative care in the research have described it as emotional closeness, but they do assert that physical expressions remain important. So all the references are at the end of the slides. I haven't referenced them as I'm going through. And also what we'd like to say is that sexuality is whatever the patient says it is. We realized while we were doing this trial and also before we even started that there are two taboo subjects in our society which we don't talk about very much. And the first one is death and dying, and the second one is sexuality. So when you put them together, that's where you're going to be getting all your conflicts and your difficulty in opening these conversations. And I'll show you again later on where they are, why these difficulties occur. So I'm moving on to the next slide now. The heading is also sexuality and intimacy. Often sexuality and intimacy are used interchangeably. Arguably, intimacy is just a euphemism for sexuality. We do find that people do find it difficult to use the word sex, just like people find it difficult to use the word death. There are so many euphemisms for both of those situations, as we all know. We found that intimacy is about communication, identity, mutual acceptance, and closeness. We can really say that this is the same as what sexuality is about. Sexual communication is about sexual acts and sexual deeds are about communication, how people identify as themselves and with each other, how they accept each other, and how they have mutual closeness. I'm moving on to the next slide now, which is what is sexuality and intimacy. So the staff quotes from the survey, sexuality, which was the question we asked, what do you see sexuality and intimacy as? It's the closeness between two consenting people, meaning hugging, kissing, and sexual intercourse. It's an expression of sexual needs, and it can include intimacy, romantic needs, emotional needs, and the need for closeness and affection. They also said it is the closest and intimate relationship, giving an expression of love, which is often physical. So there was an acknowledgement that sometimes it was not a sexual act, but rather closeness, and giving and receiving of such expressions. And what was also a nice quote was that it's self-worth and appreciation within a couple for one another. I'm moving on to the next slide now. One of the reasons there's a problem with sexuality and in palliative care is that health professionals have a tendency to assume that people with life-limiting diseases are too sick or too old to continue to be sexual beings. And the staff's quotes from the survey actually proved that in the research, confirmed the research findings, I should say. It's very difficult to talk about sex and sexuality because most of our patients are old and too sick to discuss things related to sexuality and intimacy. And one of them was quite blunt and said palliative care patients in the ring are too sick to think about sexuality, so really we don't need to improve sexuality and intimacy conversations. All right, so I'm going on to the next slide. It says, okay, so why is sexuality and intimacy important in palliative care? This is what the research has showed, that sometimes there is a deep and profound regret in the bereaved person that they were unable to provide the intimacy that they knew that their partner wanted. And one of the quotes that one of our staff said was, we all remember the first time that we make love, but it would be nice to remember the last time. And in a palliative care situation, we would like to be able to have the opportunity to provide the patients with the opportunity and their partners the opportunity to acknowledge and to actually provide that intimate love, physical or emotional or whatever they want to do. We want to be able to provide them with that opportunity to do that for their loved one. So patients whose sexual needs remain unidentified and unacknowledged assume that their sexual concerns are irrelevant. I'm just moving on to the next slide, which says that research shows overwhelmingly that patients value sexuality and they want discussions and opportunities to discuss it. But there is an imposed abstinence, reduced displays of affection and emotional disengagement that occurs, and I'll talk about it later, about what actually causes this, especially in a palliative care situation. A holistic approach to palliative care would include a professional discussion of sexuality, which is as important as physical symptoms. So I'm moving on to the next slide now, which is myths about sexuality and palliative care. I've already discussed some of them, that people think they're too sick to be sexual. But there are other myths that are related to sexuality in any situation, really. You have to be young in order to be sexual. You have to be beautiful and desirable. Our media is actually very much on that, that people are have to be beautiful and desirable to be considered sexy. You have to have a heterosexual partner to have sex. I hope that kind of myth is moving on now, certainly in our two countries, New Zealand and Australia. If your partner dies, it's the end of your sex life, is another myth. Older people should be looking after their grandchildren, not having any sexual needs. I think it's difficult enough for our children and our adult children to realize that older people have sexual needs, not to mention grandparents having sexual needs. There are definitely derogatory terms about older people which are prevalent. I mean, I can think of things like, I think one of my slides later on talks about a patient who says, I felt like a dirty old man. That is certainly one of the derogatory terms about older people that might be prevalent. There are also myths of aging which tend to be negative rather than positive, and you can't have sexual needs if you are sick, which I've said before. And dying individuals and their loved ones are viewed as asexual. I'm quite sure that people can talk about situations when patients are talked about as patients in room number 5 or room number 6. And also we tend to talk sometimes, and says I'm not too sure about in a palliative care situation, I haven't seen that recently, but we talk about patients by their diagnoses. You know, the patient with breast cancer in room 5. Certainly, how on earth we would review them as being sexual beings if we can't even put a name to that person. We really struggle to view people who are sick and dying as having sexual needs. I hope I'm not getting you all confused with the slides, but I've just got a few pictures there of two elderly couples having a lovely kiss with each other, and the excitement on the lady's face. I hope you can see this slide. It's entitled More Myths About Sexuality. So what are the perceived barriers to sexuality and intimacy in palliative care? So this is the next slide, and that's the heading for it. The three barriers that we identified and the research identified as well were staff barriers, patient barriers, and systemic barriers. So the staff barriers were embarrassment to raise the subject, vulnerability, and safety in a medicalized approach. It's much easier. We often find this as a case. It's often easier to give a breakthrough dose of medication for pain if a patient is showing anxiety instead of being able to sit down and talk to them. And the same approach might happen if someone says that they need to be, not that our patients would broach the conversation because so many patients are embarrassed to do it, unless nurses feel confident to actually bring the subject up, they might feel embarrassed and they might feel vulnerable. Patients talking about having sexual needs in the middle of the night might make a nurse feel completely vulnerable. Also, we may have there might be negative sexual experiences by healthcare professionals that they have experienced themselves in their own personal lives, or else in any kind of sexual harassment or issues that patients, nurses may have had in the past with patients being inappropriate to them. And this can make them feel embarrassed to bring up the subject. There is the expectation that patients need to focus on the physical symptoms of their disease and are too sick to think about intimacy and sexuality. And one of the staff quotes was, "How can I bring up the issue of sex? I've got far more important things to address with them, and like pain and symptom control and your spiritual and existential needs." Certainly, sexual needs are the last thing on our list. I'm moving on to the next slide. We're looking at staff quotes and our evidence, our research results. The reasons that staff struggled to open were lack of training. Almost 85% said they had no lack of training. This concern that the patients are embarrassed because of their age and culture was 76%. And interestingly enough, we're a very multicultural unit here. We have a lot of people from Nepal, nurses from Nepal, nurses from the Philippines, nurses from, I'm from South Africa. There are nurses as well from Zimbabwe, all over the place. And we weren't too sure whether the nurses were talking about their culture, being embarrassed to ask the question, or the patient's culture. What we said to them in the education sessions was actually, don't tell me it's your culture, because all of our cultures, whether we're Western from another country, Western countries, or from the Philippines, or from Nepal, all of us struggle with this issue of bringing up a patient's sexual needs. And also the age of the patient. Many patients are elderly, and they might find it disrespectful to be asked questions by a 20-year-old nurse about their sexuality. So definitely those were issues that our nurses discussed in the education sessions that we did. I will digress a bit. I'm sure the results are further on in my talk. But what patients have actually said is that when someone broaches the subject, they can, even if the staff appear embarrassed by it, at least they, if they are genuine and they appear caring, the patients who've had these questions asked to them have actually said that they do not take offense by it. That's the results that are shown in the literature. We haven't studied that in our study. Lack of time. Nurses, of course, always have a problem with lack of time. We'd like to make sure that our palliative care patients get time to be talked to, but nurses often say that there is no time. Sometimes they're very task-focused instead of being able to sit down and chat. And they also, 50%, only 50%, which is quite low, we thought, said that they felt it was too intrusive to ask those questions. As I mentioned before, we have had instances where patients, staff have been embarrassed by intimacy. So I'm moving on to the next slide now, which says patient barriers. Certainly there are patient barriers where advanced illness affects the patient's appearance and therefore his or her sense of being sexy. There's surgery, cachexia, the odor of tumors, pain, all of these contribute. We mouth care and mouthwash. We try so hard to keep our patients' mouth not malodorous, but when you talk about kissing and cuddling, some of our patients feel so embarrassed, it might also make them feel not sexy. And grooming and appearance are important aspects of sexuality, and putting patients into white hospital gowns and certainly doesn't make anyone feel sexy. Also, there might be changes in sexual desire and functioning, for example, limitations of their illness and from mastectomy and prostatectomy, and they just don't feel sexy. Social concerns, this is again is about being worried about what people will think, and the staff may think I'm just a dirty old man. The shyness of patients to initiate the conversation, I don't want to make the staff feel embarrassed, and I was searching for the right person who would understand what I was feeling. And in the research, again, I would like to reiterate that patients want us to do this, to initiate the conversation, because they have these barriers. And they want us to be able to facilitate making it easier for them to open the conversation with us and with their partners. So I'm going to move on to the next slide, which is entitled Systemic Barriers. We all know that there is a lack of privacy in a hospital. Sometimes they share rooms with other patients. We do have a few shared rooms, but we do try to accommodate that if there is a couple, they always have a private room. There are constant interruptions and single beds. And I certainly think that we try to knock on the door when we go into a patient's room, but I've yet to see a nurse wait or someone else wait for the patient or their family members to say, come in, before we knock on the door. So that certainly, we're trying to have we try to give them privacy, but certainly knocking on the door doesn't really work in a normal situation. And also embarrassment by the health personnel if the patient should mention the subject. And that's why patients don't mention the subject, of course. So in the answers that the staff gave, the staff said they were too sick to think about it. 93.4% said patients or staff were too sick. Embarrassment on the side of the staff was 85%, and 85% also said there was no privacy. So they did back up our research. There is a bit of discrimination in, not really discrimination, but one of the systemic barriers is that people still use the word husband and wife, and so someone who is not in a heterosexual relationship might find that another barrier to even opening the conversation. Another systemic barrier is there's a diffusion of responsibility, the old saying where everyone expected everyone else to do it, so no one did it. So whose role is this to do it? So we, our staff members, were asked this question, and 80% said doctors, 75% said social worker, and 70% said nurses should be doing it. So we came up with the theory that this was a multidisciplinary approach. And that's what we did in our education, was we said to people, this is not any, it's everyone's responsibility. If someone at 2 o'clock in the morning is expressing the need for some love and intimacy with their partner, then the nurse at 2 o'clock in the morning needs to be able to have the tools and the skill to be able to answer those questions and not say, I'll give you some Ativan and the staff can speak to you about it in the morning, which sometimes at 2 o'clock in the morning might be the tempting thing to do. I hope I haven't got you lost on my slides. The next slide I'm looking at is how can we help? This is what we did, having had the research study. We want to normalize sexuality. We want to educate the staff. And we wanted to provide resources to facilitate sexuality. Aromatherapy, encourage communication between patients and their partners, and give them time alone together. The good news is that, this is my next slide, the good news that we've looked up in the research, the research shows, is that physiological changes should not be confused with the capacity for love and intimacy. So patients who've got a really bad cancer can still have a capacity and a need for love and intimacy. We may be satiable when it comes to sex, but insatiable when it comes to being loved. And adult psychological health is associated with sexual compatibility and connectedness. There's no fixed biological limit to a satisfactory sex life during old age. That is in the evidence. And older persons' sexual activity level is correlated to their sexual activity and enjoyment before, during, and after their middle years. So the staff wanted to ask me, what do you mean by that? And I said to them, no one actually knows what happens between a couple in a marriage or in a relationship. What is normal for one couple is not normal for another. So that's why we can't say that 3 times a week is a good number of times to have sex, because who knows, in the beginning of your relationship, 5 times a day might be a good time to have sex. But 30 years down the line, that would be considered abnormal in a relationship to that couple. So everyone's sexual needs are completely and utterly individual. And therefore, we need to see what the patient, every single individual person, needs to be considered. So, what I was saying, I explained to the staff about that, is that if you enjoyed sex in your early years, then you will enjoy it in your later years as well. We just need to consider the individual needs of every single person. So the next slide says, how can we put sexuality and intimacy on the agenda in Neringa? So staff suggestions from the survey were, as I said before, training. They wanted champions so that if they didn't feel comfortable they would have someone that they could refer to for the conversations. They wanted ways to ensure that the patients have privacy, and some of them suggested pamphlets, including it in the admission form and the consent form. So what did we do? So the next slide is a title slide. It says, what did we do at Naringa? Now, DeVoit et al. 2011 described a team approach, a STEP skills model, which we implemented at Naringa. So the next slide says, step one, we discussed that a sexuality and intimacy attitude needs to be developed. We acknowledge that they are sexuality and intimacy are basic and enduring aspects of being human. And we did a schedule of education given to all staff, including medical, nursing, and allied health staff. So that was the first step was the whole change of attitude. This is actually a need. We do need to do this, even though you think they might be too sick or it's a difficult conversation. The research shows that people need it, so we need to change our entire attitude. Step two, we allocated roles. So not every team member has got the skills or the confidence. Even if we can educate someone as much as we can, people sometimes do not want to have this conversation. And we can't take nurses and other staff members out of their comfort roles and to discuss the private issues. We can't force people to do it because you can't change your nature. Everyone has their own strengths and weaknesses. So what we did was we wanted to allocate each person a role which is clear and complementary. We need to make sure we aren't all saying the same thing to the patient. That was very, very important because sometimes you'll have a social worker talking about their sexual needs and then the nurse will walk in and say the same thing. So we document very carefully what conversations have been had, and we also document it in our nursing handover sheet so that all the nurses know about it. So we've got two roles that we've discussed, which DeVoit et al. Described as well. They're called the spotters and the champions. So the spotters are the staff in direct contact with the patient and their partner. And they look for cues that the patient needs a sexuality and intimacy discussion. We have conversation openers, so I'll show you that on a later slide. And they can refer to champions. So we educated the staff that if someone asks you at 2 o'clock in the morning, I just feel so lonely and I need someone to cuddle, not for them to feel confronted, but for them to say I endorse what you're feeling. It's a completely normal, completely natural, and what can we do to help you with it? And then refer them to the champions if they don't feel comfortable to continue with that conversation. The second slide. Now I like my Dalmatians. So I've got a picture of a Dalmatian. He's a spotter, so he's checking out all the cues. And then the second role is a champion, and they would have extra training, and they would have a role in personal preference. And currently we have at least two people. We've allocated two people for this role, but this was in 2016 when we initiated this. We've probably got about four or five now. We've got a social worker, staff specialist, occupational therapy, and two of our nurses who have been trained up to be confident in having these discussions. We worked out the implicit method of communication, which is a step-by-step approach. The first one is permission. Limited information is LI. Sorry, I've moved on to another. I hope I'm not losing you on my slides. This slide is headed training. So PLICIT stands for P is permission, LI is limited information, SS is specific suggestions, and IT is intensive therapy. So most patients only need permission and limited information, and most staff members can only cope with permission and limited information. So it's important for the staff to realize they can stop at any time during the communication and refer to a champion at any time. The next slide, I'm just explaining what PLICIT is. So permission is having a willingness to discuss it. It involves asking permission, to talk about sexual topics. It involves giving permission to them as a sexual being, and followed by an open-ended invitation to have this conversation. An example would be, it's normal for you to feel this. What concerns are you having? Then you've got the next slide. Again, I'm still talking about permission. Part of this is being able to interpret cues from a patient or their partners. So one cue might be if you have a couple, and as soon as that's a cue, anyone who's in a relationship with a couple who are with them all the time and caring for them in the room, we would ask them for a companion bed, if they would like a companion bed. So our companion beds are actually beds that we can slot in to a single bed, the patient's single beds. We don't have double beds in our unit. Really, it was for occupational health reasons, so that nurses could raise the bed and lower the bed and not bend over looking for caring for patients. So that's why we haven't gone with that method. I think the second reason is because our doors are not wide enough to push double beds through. Another cue might be if a patient says, "I feel ugly and unloved," that is a cue of how to be able to help them see what happens. Then we go to often the conversation ends here, but we should be giving them information and permission. I beg your pardon, not information, but permission to be able to be a sexual being, asking them what are their needs, what do they want us to do for them. But sometimes the conversation may end here. The LI is limited information. This may be a discussion of how the sexuality has affected their condition, and depending on their response, will be a guide as to whether the conversation would continue. Specific information would be concrete suggestions on how to cope and encouraging the couple to have conversations. So offering them private time, massage oils, companion beds, that would be what we would be doing. The IT part is intensive therapy, and this really is not, we haven't really needed this in our inpatient unit. The occupational therapists have said that they have seen this in the community. They might need equipment to help them facilitate a sexual act. Research has shown that not many of our palliative care patients reach this stage, and we have not experienced that in our palliative care unit. So phrases on how to start the conversation and cues, I'll just go through them. This is another slide. Some people who are going through an illness like yours have been concerned about their sexuality. We ask our patients if they want a companion bed. If they say yes, then we move on to ask them if they want private time. Do you have any intimacy needs that we could help you and your partner with? A patient wants to dress up for a visitor and asks for help, and you can ask them, is this person someone special? So that would be a cue if someone is dressing up for a visitor. Would you like some private time with this person? We can also ask them, it would be hard at this stage of your illness to express physical love and sexual needs. How can I facilitate these needs for you? And you've been through so much since your diagnosis. This may affect the way you see yourself as a woman or a man. Next slide is reaction from the patients. So in a study done from Devoit and al., which I spoke about before, people do not take offense if sexuality and intimacy are brought up. I did mention this earlier. Even though some of them did not want it to be discussed, they didn't mind the gender or the age of the professional as long as they were genuine. And a person-orientated approach is wanted rather than a medical or sickness approach. So we decided not to go with the medicalized questionnaire-based approach because we felt that it was a cop-out. And so it's the staff who asked for brochures and pamphlets and included in the admission checklist. We thought, no, that's really not really what we're looking for in trying to solve this problem. Just to briefly go through what we discussed, we asked in our patient's questionnaire, was very, very simple. During your previous hospitalization, in your journey, has anyone ever asked a conversation about sexuality needs to you? And the answer was zero. We then said, if no, would you have liked to have had this conversation? And the answer was 75% said yes. And do you think discussing sexuality is an important part of holistic care? And 80% said yes. So we really only did have a very small sample. We only approached 5 patients and their partners, but it did confirm previous research findings. So what did we do at Neuringa to make this easier for patients? So the next slide is entitled The Neuringa Approach, Providing Patients with the Opportunity to Have Sexual and Intimate Time Together with Their Partners. So what we have done is a companion bed is offered to all couples. If they say yes, this is seen as a cue. We call it private couple time. We created a sign and we gave education to all the staff about what this sign means. And this sign is given to these patients and their partners. We give them a texter and we give them times in which they should be doing it. It's not dictated at all. I'll go on to the next slide, which has actually got a picture of our sign. We wanted something that was completely do not go in, and yet, of course, we didn't want to have anything that would make them feel embarrassed to put up. We put do not disturb, please do not enter from such a time to such a time, speak to the nurse in charge. So when this happens, we do not even knock. We absolutely respect this private time, and all staff have been educated about this. Now, this is easier said than done because we have cleaning staff. We have hospitality staff bringing in the tea and changing their waters and bringing in their meals. And these hospitality staff change shifts, and they actually, you get a new one in all the time. This sign we decided was clear enough. And we actually specified to patients that this is, please do not have too much time on this because we're still a hospital. We still need to do your checks. So the next slide actually shows a picture of it. And this one, we loved this one. It's not a very good picture, but we really loved it because the wife wrote 205 to 240. So she wanted 35 minutes of absolute quiet time with her husband. And we've had plenty of people who have just written 2 hours. 1 hour, 30 minutes, just any time where they can just do a kiss and a cuddle. We have had one patient and their wife who put it up all night. It was the wife who did it. She was the patient was the husband. And we actually had to ask her not to do it because we still needed to check on our patients. We are, after all, still a hospital. Right. So the next slide says... pamphlets consent form. We decided not to do that. I'm skipping through that slide. We decided not to use that method. So just a little word about a special group of people, LGBTI. I'll be honest, this group keeps on confusing me because now they've got Q and extras on. We all know we're talking about a special group who have different needs to the general population, which again might be discriminatory, those words, but we have to acknowledge that they do have additional barriers and stresses in palliative care, homophobia, failure of healthcare professionals to recognize their relationship, additional legal and financial burdens, and they also tend to seek medical attention later on in the general population. And sometimes they've never told any of their family who they are and what they're doing. What their relationship is. We had one very recently who insisted he was only the carer, and the patient said, "No, he's my partner." And we offered them a companion bed, and the carer didn't want it because he said, "I'm only a carer." But they'd been in a relationship for 15 years, so it was quite a sad situation. So what can we do about this population group? We need to be aware of their difficulties. We have sent our staff for training LGBTI awareness and how to be inclusive. We need to always use gender-neutral language, which actually is some of the elderly population in our countries. If I say, "Is this your partner?" They get quite offended and say, "Well, no, she's my wife." So we just can't win, can we? And we do need to pick up some cues. And I like these beautiful pictures as well of an elderly couple holding hands and kissing each other. So I just want to look at the summary of this talk. I don't know if any of you have got a copy of our poster that we presented at the conference in 2017, the Palliative Care Conference. If you have got it, I just wanted to show you our post-intervention survey results, where 37% of staff have initiated the conversation about sexuality after this, and 17% prior to the conversation felt comfortable doing it. And staff discomfort level improved from 17% to 36%. And they said that the most helpful interventions were the provision of the private couple sign and education. And just some of the staff comments were patients' reaction was happy and grateful. It felt very fulfilling to be able to answer these questions. The patient appeared to be intrigued and relieved. Yes, it was natural, as couples were all asking already for less distraction. I felt that I was empowered I enabled the patient just by offering. And one of them said, it's great to know that we've helped at least 15 couples have some precious, intimate moments, which is what they need so much. Now, when I say 15 couples, that was our presentation in 2017. We don't count how many we have. We've just done them, and it's working very well, and we are very, very happy with our results. Limitations of the study that we did. We're an inpatient unit. And palliative care is not just about end-of-life care. Most of the patients who benefited from the signs were receiving end-of-life care, which was good. And we only interviewed staff and a limited amount of patients and carers. So we'll put you on. I've got my, as you can see, I'm an animal passionate. There's a Jack Russell and Dalmatian, and there's a cat, which is no questions good, which I think is what we can all acknowledge with cats. Right, so I think I can put you over to question time now.